Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, and today we've got three of the experts in the field, and I guess I need to lay out which field that is. We're talking about one of the issues that has had significant challenges and even exacerbation during the COVID-19 pandemic, and that is opioid use disorders. And over the last 2 years, 2020 and still playing out in 2021, we're seeing significant spikes within overdoses driven mainly by opioid induced overdoses. And we're looking at ways that, one, we have to figure out once again how to tackle the epidemic within the pandemic. And so we brought three experts who are really our champions in the field of opioid use disorders and recovery and initiating treatment within hospitals and the emergency departments. And so the big things we want to do today is we want to discuss some of their projects and some of the things each of us as community physicians and elsewhere can do to help address and better serve the opioid use disorder in our emergency departments, communities, and hospitals. So what I'll do is I'm just going to let everybody introduce themselves, kind of give us a rundown of what they're doing. And we're going to basically go across the country, starting off with Rhode Island with Liz. So we'll let Liz kick us off here.
Hi, Ryan. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Liz Samuels. I'm an assistant professor of emergency medicine at Brown. And I'm also the consulting assistant medical director for the Rhode Island Department of Health's Drug Overdose Prevention Program. So the work that Rhode Island is, you know, small but mighty and unique in that you can really implement system-wide change in a variety of settings with a few key stakeholders who are engaged. This is a little bit different than many other places, but it's really allowed us some important opportunities to both develop and test and implement some evidence-based public health strategies to address the overdose crisis through the emergency department. So in response to legislation that was passed by the state legislature, there are certain requirements set out for emergency departments on types of care to provide patients who are treated for overdose and opioid use disorder. In response to that legislation, the Department of Health did release standards of care for treatment of overdose and opioid use disorder. Initially when those standards were set out, they were fairly general, but as an emergency physician, I was able to engage the Department of Health to try to tailor them to the emergency department setting and really work with emergency departments, both academic and community, to implement them to try to set up both strategies that would work in the emergency department setting and for patients we're seeing for opioid overdose or opioid use disorder and reduce morbidity and mortality related to opioid use disorder. And those types of programs include a wide spectrum of things from take-home naloxone, peer recovery coaching, and the topic we're going to talk about today, you know, initiation of evidence-based treatment with buprenorphine.
And moving across the country, we're going to visit in and now in a changed setting. So one of the things that you don't see when we record these podcasts, we record with video. That way we can all see each other and interact. But you're getting out just the audio. But now Andrew is moving around. And so where in the world is Andrew Herring is going to be our new subject matter after this. But Andrew, tell us a little bit about your practice and projects with regard to OUD at your setting.
Sure. Really happy to be here and part of this amazing crew with Eric and Liz and yourself. So I'm an emergency physician in Oakland, California. I also started doing addiction work. And so I run our Bridge Clinic. I had the great fortune of working with some amazing colleagues, Hannah Snyder, who's a family practice and hospitalist, Amy Mullen, who is an emergency physician at Davis, and Ariana Campbell, who's a PA in a rural hospital, to create this thing we call the California Bridge, which is, you know, really similar to what a lot of people are doing, which is getting together physicians and nurses and social workers and navigators together who are working in the ER, on the ambulances, the inpatient services, and the clinics to create a system that actually works for people who are arriving into the ER with some form of opioid-related crisis, withdrawal, overdose, craving, whatever, and try to get all these systems to work together. It's been super rewarding and fun, and I think proves the sort of obvious thing is that ERs reach a lot of people. And if you invest in ER care, you're going to see big results. So that's and that's what we're seeing, and we're really excited to talk more about it.
And then our final guest today is one that you have heard before here on the podcast. He's been one of our main go-tos for OUD, BUP, all kinds of things of that nature, and he has not learned to say no yet. So he is back with us once again, Dr. Eric Ketchum. So Eric, tell us, give us a little background of what you've got going on.
Thanks for having me, Ryan, and an honor to join Liz, excuse me, and Andrew here. Sorry for the cough, not dying of COVID. Anyway, so I've been working with buprenorphine in the ED for about 10 years now altogether, and after joining another larger hospital system, the Presbyterian system in New Mexico, and we got about six of our EDs off the ground, working with buprenorphine in the ED and in our inpatient units, and now in our labor and delivery units, we got together with some folks from University of New Mexico and formed this group that was funded by a SOAR grant. So fortunately, our Behavioral Services Division and UNM got the grant funding and pulled a group of people together. We were then able to have a family doc who's a national expert named Leslie Hayes, who does great work in OB. And we brought in a nurse educator. And what our project is we help hospitals. We work with them intensively for a few weeks or a few months to help them get all the education they need, help them build their EMR. And so therefore we get the physicians trained, their APCs, their nursing staff in particular. We really believe it's important to have nurse education and then help them build their linkages to treatment in their communities. So I work in a big state that's kind of scarcely populated for a lot of it, right? We have a couple population centers and then we have a lot of rural health is what we're doing. So it's really important for us to get people with their local resources. And so our goal with the Bridge Project in New Mexico is to make sure that we can provide a continual 24/365 resource, but also to help hospitals not only do this in the emergency department, but advance through the hospital to the inpatient units, working with hospitalists, inpatient nursing, as well as labor and delivery, and in their clinics, the prenatal care.
Yeah, so the important thing that I'm hearing here is it goes against very much what we try to do in healthcare, which is silo everything. And actually, that's been one of the biggest challenges of any type of substance use disorder, has been the fact that we have built bridges with plenty of gaps that allow people to fall through at every opportunity, which we know has increased risks of relapse and overdose and death. And all three of the projects here are kind of a multidisciplinary approach. So we'll start off with Liz, followed by Andrew, and then Eric. What are some of the things, the approaches, and key factors you see in terms of that multidisciplinary approach in tearing down those silos that have built, that have produced barriers to substance use recovery in the past?
Ryan, I think it's a really important question. I mean, I like in many of the other conditions we treat in the emergency department, we are the primary interface between the community and the healthcare and behavioral healthcare system, and have a really key opportunity to link people into try to address those gaps in care. So in terms of our program, and the new unique thing in Rhode Island, again, I think some of this is due to our size, is we really leverage community partnerships with existing organizations. This is both in terms of treatment providers, but also community-based peer recovery organizations, which can help facilitate those linkages from the ED to outpatient care. This has helped some with our hospitals in particular, who maybe don't have the resources to support a peer or a navigator on their own staff, but are able to work with these community-based partners to link patients they see at the time of the ED visit and then follow them longitudinally after their ED visit is complete. So in terms of other forms of multidisciplinary approaches that have, I think, really helped us address a lot of those gaps. In emergency medicine, we are lucky that we have several of us who are also trained or specialize in addiction medicine in addition to emergency medicine, but partnering with our toxicologists, as Eric talked about, social work, psychiatry, outpatient providers, and other addiction medicine specialists, I think has been really key.
Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think first of all, out here in California, we've got over 100 hospitals doing bridge programs. They all look a little different. So there's I'm just going to speak kind of real broadly. focusing on what, which is convenience, which is promptness. So making everything easy, making this easy for the ER tech, the nurse, the physician, the patient, that's the key. You know, in many systems, whether or not they intended to, made things hard. They put a lot of this idea of accountability of and just these friction points around your insurance status and appointment times and just on and on and on and on. But I mean, any of us on this call, I mean, if we want to get something from the store or, you know, buy a plane ticket, you know, you want things that are easy. And that's the same thing that someone struggling with opioid use disorder wants. So taking away any artificial barrier that would make it hard for a nurse or hard for a doc to identify someone with OUD and start treatment or to accept it has really been at the core. So that is a big change that we've really found that having a dedicated staff that can be a navigator, or you can call them, they can be a peer navigator, they can be a coach, they can be a, you know, community health outreach worker, you know, put whatever title you want, but they're kind of just there to model this new frame of like, no, it's okay. You can just treat this like you treat pneumonia. Just if they've got the disorder, give them the treatment, don't overthink it, right? And then bring together the clinic to the same space of, don't overthink this. You don't need a 2-hour intake appointment that's in 2 weeks. Just continue the prescription and we'll work it out, right? It's okay. It's okay. And really getting that cultural change out there and not shying away from some real sort of, you know, almost political stuff here where people who use drugs are discriminated against. So, you know, we feel very strongly that physicians should advocate for decriminalization of drugs, for example, and that you can't really destigmatize something that's illegal. So really embracing that idea of a movement of a population of people. So it's not just an opioid withdrawal that you're fixing. It's really embracing that, oh my gosh, this is an excluded group of people that have been mistreated by the medical system for decades. And now I'm part of the solution. I'm part of a vision of a better future that works. That's really what we've tried to promote here.
Liz, you have an insertion?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that I totally agree with everything Andrew said. I think, you know, mainstreaming this workflow into usual forms of care is really important. I feel like where I've seen these things fail is when it's this like extra thing on the side. There's 5 million extra steps. There's a special other place that's like the intervention occurs. And then it becomes this like, there's all of this like apprehension about it. Like it's perceived as impossible to do, or there's a big barrier, or there's like a lot of activation energy to get the thing to happen. But really like normalizing, this is a thing we treat all of the time in the emergency department. And like, just like everything else, it's a basic skill and competency we need to be able to do. And it's really not it's not that deep, not as big of a deal. We can have a huge impact. The risk of death for an overdose ED visit is so high, like we can really have a really important, meaningful change. And it's like meeting people where they're at. I mean, I think also a philosophical approach of like low barrier treatment access. We want people to do well. And like there is an understanding of there is a, you know, relapsing nature to substance use disorders. There's a ton of barriers, both, in terms of actual substance use disorder and accessing treatment and social and structural determinants of health that keep people from accessing care they need. So I think from the emergency department, trying to link people into things that can help do those wraparound services is really important, but we should be the lowest barrier entry point and have the systems that are set up for physicians, nurses, techs, PAs to be just like they would do anything else. Once you start to make it something that's like an added step or like, you know, seen as like not part of usual care, that's when people get nervous and are uncomfortable doing it.
Eric?
Yeah, I want to second all that and completely agree. In fact, really the goal of the New Mexico Bridge is really to help hospitals tear down all the barriers, right? And a lot of this may sound, you know, silly, but if we treat this like any other disease, well, you know, as a, you know, a recovering, you know, 10-year of ED medical director from running a busy ED, you know, every problem you wanted to solve, whether you're working on a great stroke program or a sepsis program or your trauma program, you solve that by making sure the equipment that you need is at the bedside, right? You make sure the medications you need are at the Pyxis where the nurse can grab them easily. And it's the same thing with treating substance use disorders, right? So that part of the barrier was just making sure you got the medication in the Pyxis, that you make sure that, you know, we put some educational material right there, brief, simple, in the EMR. So when the doc opens up that little, that order set, which we try to keep simple as possible, we make sure there's a couple statements in there. Do not wait to obtain a urine drug screen. Not necessary. Don't obtain labs. You know, even a patient pregnant, you know, even more important, if she's withdrawing, treat her quickly. You know, we just, we put links if people want to read about stuff and they want some resources, but we try to make it as simple as possible, get the medication there. We make sure that we have prepackaged take-home med packs, right? So these are all ready to go. We try to make it so the doc, when they're doing this, has to click as few things as possible in the EMR. And this is really what we teach as we go around the state. And at the same time, we want to make sure that nurses around the state really feel comfortable with this. We spend a lot of time on reducing stigma. And because we really believe that when people understand the, excuse me, the neurobiology a little bit better, and they understand the pharmacology and such, and they understand what a safe medicine is, and that the nurses get behind this. And if you really get your nurses behind this, they really help pull the providers forward. And we let people know that where you're going to make a mistake is by not using enough medication. Please write a longer script. You know, we've developed all these habits around traditional opioids because we really try to get people to prescribe less oxycodone. Please don't prescribe them more than 3 days worth, all that kind of stuff. And now we have to change that to say, look, you got to get your patient to their appointment. If you want to get into appointment, how often do you think really your patient's always going to get in to see a provider within 3 days? You know, so our standard discharge prescription for buprenorphine for IEDs, it's 2 weeks.
Right.
But really it's all about changing that mentality and then being able to work with the next level of care, working with your hospitalists and such after that, and carrying the same thing forward through the hospital.
And that's clearly the common theme that I'm hearing here is keeping it as simple as you can. This don't overthink the room. Don't, you know, everything that you put up in terms of a speed bump is an opportunity for failure in a lost patient. So keeping this as streamlined as possible, and that's a lot of the advocacy that's going on right now is dealing with taking out some of the things that naturally build bias and stigma and hesitancy, whether it's regard to the three-day rule, the X waiver, whatever it may be. So Eric, you actually mentioned early part of the funding aspect of things. And everybody knows, and everybody hates to think about it, but it's just a simple part of life. So much of what we do in the hospital setting, EM setting, is driven by dollars in, dollars out, and the cost associated with it. We've heard about grants and some things like that, but I'd like for each of you to address kind of some of that engagement and getting that financial kickstart to getting these programs in place. I'll start with you, Eric.
Well, I'm fortunate that at the University of New Mexico, where I'm just adjunct faculty, that they've done a lot of the work in gathering the funds, and the Behavioral Health Services Division, which is actually part of the state government, you know, they've done a good job of garnering the funds and have approached me a few times, you know, to help do educational projects and such. And then when they had, you know, funding to do this, we were able to say, you know, what do you need on your team? You know, so, or who do you need on your team? But what I really appreciate, at least the way that we've done it in New Mexico, at least the way they've gotten the funding, is that when we approach the hospitals, and this is federal funds, that, by the way, that have gone through a, you know, a state process, and this is a SOAR, which is, you know, state opioid response grant money. That's what we're using. But we approach the hospitals with a budget. So we show up, not only are we going to provide you with education, not only are we going to spend time helping you build your EMR, working with your pharmacists, making this as simple as possible, but also we're going to help fund your first year position of a peer support worker, in fact, to get that position off the ground. We're going to help you learn how to code and bill for their services so that position becomes sustainable. We're going to fund the nurses for their time going through our education program. We're going to fund provider time so they can get educated as well. We're going to provide you some funding to, because you're going to need to provide administrative support for this project at your hospital if you want to keep things moving on track and do some data collection for us. We know that. So that's, we understand it's important to hospitals, and that's why we show up with funding.
Yeah, I mean, this is the big question. I mean, we're operating within a, you know, a fundamentally, you know, just messed up system, so the economics are all a little screwed. But your basic opportunities here are, you've got the payers, right? And so hospitals might actually make money from ED visits, but then the payer, the health plan, will lose. Then you've got some things that are really well aligned. Like, everybody wins if you prevent a readmission. Everybody wins if you limit the number of non-billable inpatient days. And then you've got grant funding from the feds, which is actually a thing. You know, with the opioid settlement, you know, we can all expect, you know, 15 years of funding. So the economics are this complex mix of health system-based benefit, health plan benefit, and then successful leveraging of federal funding. Ultimately, you want something that works, which is, I think, what we've all been pointing to. Within this system, the one piece we haven't talked about is that the health plan, right, will win if you can create an ambulatory visit that gets billed instead of a ER visit. And so that's where you get into this thing of how do emergency departments work within that reality. And one thing I encourage people to really think about is, to what degree can your ER department do ambulatory work? So we're seeing a lot of ER physicians open bridge clinics and kind of straddle this divide between acute and ambulatory care, which in my mind is totally artificial. It's not, humans don't live their life in these sort of separated universes. And it looks like that it's primarily emergency physicians who kind of really grasp what this means. So people like Eric and Liz who kind of get it. So there's a world there where you can drive revenue by creating basically an ambulatory experience that people want to go to instead of the ER, and really focusing on choice, not force. You're not saying you can't go to the ER. You're creating an experience that's so effective and convenient and positive, they choose to go to it. And that's sort of a place where everybody wins. But the bottom line is, right now in the current state, is if you create an effective program that reaches people, gets buprenorphine into their mouth, you are going to be able to get funding because of what's coming through with the federal support.
And interesting, a lot of times, like even in our case, and Andrew, I don't know if you know this, we're hijacking your plan in Kentucky by bringing in Alicia to do our talk for our national, for our state meeting coming up in November. And really, it was the state that, it's the state approached us and said, hey, we've got all this money. Yeah. And nobody's coming after it. We need to spend it. Do you want to do a program? We're like, absolutely, we want to do a program. Yeah. And helping put all that together. There's a lot of monies out there. You just have to work on asking around with the state and federal resources. Liz, your thoughts on the funding side?
Yeah, Rhode Island we have a bit of a different funding situation than New Mexico, but a lot of what Andrew said, I think, also really resonates. You know, we have a patchwork of funding that has both supported hospitals and implementation and enhanced implementation. So there, you know, there is many states do have available state funding, either through SAMHSA streams, settlement streams, all CDC streams as well. Actually, many of the projects I work on both are funded through some combination of SAMHSA funding, both CDC program funding, both allocated through the state, CDC research funding. Doctors Francesca Bodwin and Jeanette Baird are co-PIs on a study enhancing ED treatment of opioid use disorder pathways. And that has been provided a lot of support in terms of the education that Eric talked about and the training and engagement of nurses. We wouldn't have otherwise had any funding to do that. The initial implementation of our hospital standards of care was like, me, an unfunded research fellow, being like, hi, I'm here to help you develop your protocols, which is like very bare bones, right? Then having like, you know, people who can teach and resources and like supplies and like real actual technical like resources for technical assistance. We are fortunate in that like ACIP has provided a lot of the resources and training for us in a centralized warehouse, a repository, I guess, more than a warehouse, online that community hospitals can access, which, you know, I think hasn't always been available, but is a really rich source. And then for those of us who are researchers, NIH, NIDA in particular, has and does provide a lot of support for both a research and also evaluation of interventions to reduce morbidity and mortality related to substance use disorders from the ED. And then two other things I just want to say about the payers. What Andrew said about the health plans is totally accurate. Also, CMS, you can now bill for ED buprenorphine initiation. There's information available for how to do that for your practice and like what kind of billing documentation requirements are needed for your ED. But we work with payers all of the time to talk about quality improvement and incentive programs to improve types of care delivered in the emergency department. And our department has had negotiations with payers around, how we treat substance use disorders or how we provide linkages. And you can get for your department certain types of quality incentives from these payers to try to support the types of programs or experiences that Andrew mentioned in terms of linkages to care. And then I did just want to, I know we don't have a ton of time, so I just wanted to add one thing about the last question, if that's okay, Ryan. We do like many, many more difficult things in emergency medicine than start someone on buprenorphine. Like so many more things we do have higher risks of complication and are much more technically involved. But we have a lot of apprehension about this skill, mostly because I think it's kind of unknown and has a lot of regulatory barriers. But I would just really encourage people when you're caring for someone with a substance use disorder in ED, just kind of go back to basics. Like think about how would you want your family member or your friend or yourself to be treated? And like, what would you want to happen to them after their ED visit? And I think, centering that when you're like approaching the patient with substance use disorder, I think can be like a helpful reframe and grounding, because it is a challenging system to navigate. But we do have really effective tools that are really easy to use. That's all the thing I want to add. Sorry, Ryan.
That's not a problem at all. And as you referenced the eQual site for ASAP in terms of the opioid resources, we only got a few minutes because I got to set these guys free for another OUD meeting coming up here very shortly. And so briefly, like 30 seconds each or so, getting buy-in. How do you get administrative and leadership buy-in when we're trying to introduce this to the hospital? Eric?
Yeah, that's a really important question and touches on what Andrew talked about earlier. So when you're talking to, the docs, often they want to know, how do you make this easy? How do you make their lives better in the emergency department, right? When you're engaging nurses, how do you make this a more comfortable interaction? How do you lower those barriers, improve what they know, reduce the stigma? But from a senior leadership perspective, because you got to get senior leadership on board if you really want to carry this sort of through the hospital, right? You want this to be sustainable. And you approach them with the data. This is how you reduce not well-reimbursed ED visits. This is how you reduce not well-reimbursed hospitalizations and prolonged hospitalizations and repeat hospitalizations. And I also work in a system that's a part of a health, it's part health plan, but it's also a multi-hospital system. So being able to touch on all those financial benefits to the hospital as well as to the health plan certainly goes a long way.
Yeah, I think every hospital is different. The economics really vary. In some places it's a little cynical. It's getting a given population out of your hospital as quickly as possible and into a safety net system. And that's just the reality that some people live in. So, navigators can be really helpful in that regard. In other places, it's really embracing the safety net role and doing a really good job at it. At some level, the basic message, I think, to your CEO, your COO, and all that kind of thing is that there's funding to do this, right? That it's out there. And the second message is that it's good for staff morale, is that if you want to retain mid-career physicians who are good at what they do, this is a fantastic place to reduce the burnout that you're going to see all over the hospital and produce positive change that people can embrace and celebrate and publicize and just become this obvious recognized intervention for a huge epidemic that's going on.
Yeah, I totally agree with what was already said. I think another thing is this is a national crisis. I think many hospital administrators are under a lot of pressure to be seen as part of the solution. And what are they doing as part of the solution? At least that's the case in Rhode Island. And I think this is a really clear way that you can present a plan for them to be a part of that. Again, the, the economics and the goals and the mission of each hospital is going to be a little bit different. But this is effective. This is safe and can meet any hospital's quality care standards and performance metrics and improve them for this particular patient population. And I think can be communicated as such, like depending on like your own institution's priorities and goals.
All right, everybody with a handle or a contact email. Go ahead, Liz, what do you got in case people have more questions?
You can email me at elizabeth_samuels@brown.edu, or you can send me a tweet at Liz Samuels.
Just my Gmail, andrew.a.herring, H-E-R-R-I-N-G, at Gmail.
And Eric?
Probably best to use my hospital email address now, eketcham at phs.org. And of course, you can also go to our website, which is nmbridge.org, which we shamelessly copied from Andrew Herring's work with California Bridge.
That's right. cnbridge.org. Check it out. It's huge.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the best thing about this. Don't reinvent the wheel. There's plenty of great information and experts out there. As for me, you can contact me, rstanton@asep.org, rstanton@asep.org, at EverydayMed on Twitter. I invite everybody to get this information, build your programs. We got to do the things that we can do to decrease the burden on our patients, and especially those with opioid use disorders that have been exacerbated so badly by the COVID-19 pandemic. There are plenty of resources out there. EQUAL, you heard about the bridges. Get that information introduced to your hospital. Until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.